Okay, good morning, everybody. It's about 2:41, and the date is the 25th of October. And we're going to be in Sensory Chapter today. That's Chapter 10. Don't know if we'll finish that today. Maybe not. Let's see. Last time you had a quiz, exam number 2. They're graded. They're in Blackboard. Most of you, or some of you, have seen your tests. So you're welcome to come by office hours. Review your tests, and of course, you probably should do that just to see how I write questions and learn how to answer the questions better for next time. That's probably a good thing, but also double check to make sure it's graded properly. And then just double check, make sure that the grade I put in Blackboard is the proper grade. And you can do all kinds of work. It's just a manual entry of information, so I can't make mistakes. And also in Blackboard, be aware that an instructor could put a minus number. Sometimes Blackboard puts a minus sign in front of the grade, and in that case, guess what's going to happen? It's going to subtract that score from your overall grade. So make sure in Blackboard you only get positive numbers, no negative numbers, right? So please look at that. All right, so the other thing about the schedule right here, we're going to do endocrinology and some muscle next week. The next exam is on a Thursday on the 15th. So our first two exams were on Tuesday, and so that leads me to think that the next two exams are going to be on a Thursday, and indeed they are. Okay, so just be aware of that if you're taking a Thursday lab, that you do have an exam that day. And let's see what else. Oh, I lost my recorder, my voice recorder. I looked around all over the place. I looked in the car, I looked at home, looked in the office, couldn't find it. And then I went to the gym, and I found it in my gym bag. So I do have my recorder back, and since I haven't uploaded any lectures, but I'll try to upload all the lectures, okay, starting with this one. Okay, anybody have any questions? No questions? Okay, good. So all the remaining exams, I think you're good to go. You know how to use the study guides and all that information. So let's get started with sensory. I don't know what's better. Maybe like that. And then like this. Okay, so sensory receptors are special devices that transduce energy. All right, so they transduce some kind of energy form that's in the environment into action potentials. Because remember, action potential is the language of the brain. And what can you tell me about an action potential? They're all the same, right? They have the same amplitude, same duration. They're just a little tiny blip. And what makes a difference in signal intensity or in terms of action potentials is just how frequently they get bunched together in time. And we call that frequency coding. Right, so if there's a bunch of action potentials in a very short period of time, that means a more intense signal. If there's only a few for that same period of time, that means that it's a very weak kind of signal. All right, so don't forget, the receptor transduces or changes one form of energy into another form, and these action potentials are what? Like electrochemical energy. All right, and each kind of receptor responds to a particular modality the best. For instance, photoreceptors respond to light. Pressure receptors respond to pressure, maybe vibration. And sound receptors in your ears respond to vibrations as well that are in air. So different modalities are perceived as being different because of the pathways that take them into the central nervous system. Because every action potential is the same, right? It all depends on where that action potential goes. So if an action potential goes to the occipital lobe, then somebody will perceive some kind of visual experience, right? Because the occipital lobe is the primary visual cortex. If it goes to the temporal lobe, that's where the primary auditory cortex is. So you'll have some kind of experience of hearing something, right? And so every sensation is perceived as it's special because of the area of the cortex that gets stimulated by something that's always exactly the same, and that is an action potential. So some nerve endings or some receptors can just be free nerve endings, like I see wrapped around this hair follicle right here. When a hair follicle moves, that sends up excitation of these neurons, which then sends information to the brain as action potentials. And does anybody know where these signals end up? It's just going to be somatic sensation. It's just the primary somatosensory area of the brain. And that is the postcentral gyrus. Is that kind of ringing a bell in the parietal lobe? The precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex, and then right on the other side, posterior to the central sulcus, is the primary sensory region, and that's where those signals would go, so that you would have a perception on some surface area of your body. Or receptors could be specialized nerve endings, like a Purkinje corpuscle, kind of looks like an onion. It has layers and layers and layers of membranes. Okay, and a Meissner's corpuscle would be another example. A Ruffini's end organ here would be another example. You see the Purkinje corpuscle very deep in the integument. So the Purkinje corpuscle responds to deep pressure, and severe vibrations that make its way all the way through the integument, while the Meissner's and Ruffini's end organs are much more sensitive. And as a matter of fact, somebody can even read a language with a Meissner's corpuscle because it's so sensitive when it is feeling dots on a piece of paper. What's that language called? Yeah, Braille. Okay. So some of these nerve endings are pretty specialized. All right, we can also group sensory receptors by the kind of stimulus that they respond to. Chemoreceptors respond to chemical stimuli, like glucose receptors or pH receptors. What does a pH receptor respond to? Hydrogen ion concentration. Yeah, photoreceptors respond to light. So light energy then is transduced or changed into action potentials in the eye, and those action potentials end up in the occipital lobe. Thermoreceptors respond to changes in temperature. Mechanoreceptors, when a cell is deformed, right, when it changes shape, just a mechanical difference in the shape causes action potentials. Right, we call that a mechanoreceptor, for instance, for vibration and pressure. Nociceptors respond to damaging kinds of stimuli that are painful. So nociceptor is important for pain perception. And proprioceptors signal body position. There are proprioceptors in every muscle and every tendon in your body, and even in joint capsules, so that your cerebellum knows exactly how much tension is being used or applied by every muscle in your body, what the angulation of various joints are, and if it's in within normal range, and if you're losing control of your body. So if you're walking and all of a sudden you trip and a bunch of tension develops in a particular muscle because you're moving in a way that you didn't think your body should be moving, then the cerebellum notices those changes right away and then counteracts, takes some measures so that we don't trip and fall as a result most of the time. So those are proprioceptors. So there are tension and stretch receptors that are proprioceptors. We can also characterize them, and this is probably one of the more useful ones, by location. And we have two different categories. We have general senses versus special senses. Most of the chapter we're going to be talking about special senses today, so it's important that you know what the difference is. All right, a general or cutaneous, where's your cutaneous membrane at? That's your skin. That's another way of saying your integument, right? Are near the epithelial surface. That responds to touch, pressure, temperature, and pain. And you have these receptors all over your body because you have skin all over the body. So receptors that you have everywhere are what we call general receptors or general senses. So here are some examples of general senses. That would be touch, pressure, temperature, pain. Okay, so if you have more than two receptors and they're located all over your body, then that's a general sense. A special sense, on the other hand, is where there are a few of these and there's only one or two locations on your body where those receptors exist, and they're usually fairly complicated, right? But the reason why they're special is because you don't have them all over the body, like proprioceptors, for instance, that you have in every muscle. So some special senses would be vision, because you only have two eyes. So if I shine a light on your belly button, could you see it? No, because you don't have photoreceptors there. If I shine it on your earlobe, you can't see it. But if I shine it in your eyes, aha, you can see it. So that is a special sense. All right, the same thing for hearing. If I put a tuning fork on your kneecap, would you be able to hear it? No, but if I put it up by your ear, you will be able to hear it, because it's a special sense. Only your ears can transduce sound energy into action potentials. Okay, and then if I put a sugar cube, how about if I put a sugar cube on your big toe? Will you be able to taste it? No. What about your little finger? Can you taste it? No. Some insects probably can do that because they have taste receptors, but humans can't, right? You can only taste things with your tongue. So that is a special sense as well. All right, so, and that sense of, the sense of taste is the gustatory sense, and the same thing for smell. Okay, you can only smell with your nose. All right, so vision, hearing, taste, which is gustation, and equilibrium. There are two forms of equilibrium that we're going to study. Those are special senses as well because you have specially organized organs in your inner ear that afford these two equilibrium senses. So they are special senses as well. All right, so that's the big difference between general and special. Let's talk about some differences in receptors. So here we have a couple graphs, and we see that we apply a stimulus and we hold the stimulus constant over a certain period of time and then turn it off. And we apply this to a receptor, maybe for instance for pain. And what can you tell me about the action potentials near the time when we turn the stimulus on compared to near the time when we turn the stimulus off? What about the amplitude? The same. What about the width? The same. But that's true of all action potentials, so that's not too exciting new information for you. But what about the frequency or number of action potentials per time at the beginning compared to the end? Yeah, it's the same. You see the same period of time between these action potentials, this is the same. So this is what we call a tonic receptor. It does not fatigue. It doesn't adapt to the stimulus intensity. So it's always going to provide for the same number of action potentials per time during the whole length that the stimulus is being applied. That's a tonic receptor. Let's look down here at the second example. We turn the stimulus on, exactly the same stimulus. We don't change the amplitude or intensity of the stimulus. And then at some later time, we turn it off. But now when we look at action potentials, we see something is changing here. Of course, the amplitude doesn't change because why? Because it's an action potential. The width of these action potentials isn't changing. Why? Because it's an action potential, right? These things never change. But look at the frequency in time, right? Or the number of action potentials in time changes. They come very rapidly one after each other when the stimulus is applied, and then this receptor fatigues, okay, and it generates fewer and fewer action potentials per time, and that is how our mind interprets the intensity of this particular stimulus. So the person is losing that ability to detect that stimulus when the rate of action potentials decreases going through that particular part of the cerebral cortex. This thing right here is what we call adaptation. There are many receptors that adapt. And some of those would be vibration and deep pressure. Pacinian corpuscles adapt. So if I were to grab your fingertip and press really, really hard, okay, and keep pressing really hard, as soon as I grabbed your finger and started pressing hard, you'd say, oh, ouch. Okay, and then if I wouldn't change the intensity, then sooner or later you would even forget that I'm holding onto your finger because those receptors adapt, okay, and you don't feel that stimulus anymore. Another one would be for olfaction or the sense of smell. Okay, I know just about every library has a particular smell about it. It just smells like a bunch of old textbooks, and when you first walk into a library, at least from my experience, I know I'm walking into a library, but after about 10 minutes, right, if I fell asleep and woke up or something, and I'd probably have to look around to see if I was in a library because I couldn't smell that particular odor anymore. So smell is also a rapidly adapting sort of sense that we have. Okay, here's an important law. The law of specific nerve energies says that the stimulation of a sensory nerve fiber evokes only the sensation of that particular modality. Right, and that's because only certain receptors can send action potentials to a particular part of the brain. So the hearing receptors in our ear send information only to the primary auditory cortex, and that gives us the sensation of hearing something. And so the stimulus for hearing, right, is sound energy, and we call that the adequate stimulus. The adequate stimulus is what is the normal stimulus that can excite a receptor in the most efficient way, right? So Adequate stimulus requires the least amount of energy to activate its particular kind of receptor. Maybe a good example of this would be photoreceptors in our eyes. Right? The adequate stimulus for photoreceptors would be light. Okay, that would be the most efficient way to stimulate photoreceptors, but we could stimulate those receptors in a different way. Like, for instance, maybe you weren't thinking as you're walking into the classroom and the door was closed and you hit your head on the door, okay, and you saw something. You would see like flashes of light, right? So some mechanical disruption of the retina will send action potentials to the occipital lobe, right? And so that mechanical disruption will give you the perception of vision. It won't make any sense. It's not going to look like a newspaper or anything in particular. So that is not an adequate stimulus. So mechanical deformation of the retina will stimulate the retina, but it's not an adequate stimulus, right, to produce that visual experience. And in order to see things that are not there from a mechanical disruption, it has to be a fairly severe kind of trauma to see stars, right? So that's why it is not an adequate stimulus. All right, so here are some examples of different kind of receptors and what the normal stimulus is. So adequate stimulus is not the amount of energy, it's a type of energy that can excite a receptor. Adequate stimulus is a type of energy, not the intensity. All right, so the job of a receptor is to produce graded potentials that scale as the intensity of the stimulus increases. And then if a generator potential reaches threshold, then an action potential ensues in this afferent neuron, and away it goes to the brain. And how do signals get to the proper location in the cerebral cortex? They got to pass through a part of the central nervous system. Maybe somebody can remember from anatomy what part that is. But sensory information has to pass through nucleus in the brain before it gets to the cerebral cortex. And that is the thalamus. That's right. The thalamus is the relay station. Okay, and the thalamus directs these action potentials to the proper part of your brain so that you have the proper sensation. All right, so generator potentials are these receptor cell equivalents of what, an IPSP or an EPSP? They're always going to be excitatory. Right, so these are EPSPs, and if they can summate, for instance, because they're just graded potentials, they can summate in time, they can summate spatially. Right, and once it reaches threshold, then this action potential is going to find its way to the proper part of the cerebral cortex for that perception of whatever energy was applied to your body. All right, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity, because remember, only action potentials have the same amplitude. So as the stimulus intensity increases, so does the generator potential. Okay. After threshold is reached, the action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. I'll see if I can explain that a little bit better. Right. In phasic receptors, the generator potential adapts to constant stimulus and quickly diminishes in amplitude. We talked about that already. So let's take a look at this slide. We have three different stimuli. We have a low intensity, medium intensity, and I can see that this medium intensity is actually producing some action potentials on the top line. So this is a threshold stimulus. And then we have a supra threshold stimulus right here. We have a very strong stimulus. So we're going to compare these three different stimuli. And we also get the generator potentials. This first stimulus produces a graded potential or a generator potential in the receptor, which does not meet threshold. And since it doesn't meet threshold, then no action potentials are generated, and the central nervous system gets no information from this receptor, so you're completely, if this was a photoreceptor, then you would be completely blind to this stimulus, right? Or you couldn't tell if there's a change in temperature, if it was a temperature stimulus, or if it was an olfactory stimulus. You couldn't notice any change in smell or anything, okay? But now if we increase the intensity, right, it produces generator potential or graded potential, which now reaches threshold, and that will then produce these four action potentials. And remember, after an action potential, there is a relative refractory period, which means then that that stimulus that's being applied not only has to reach threshold, but it also has to overcome that period of hyperpolarization. which delays the onset of the following action potential. So in this particular case, the frequency of action potentials is relatively slow because this is just barely a threshold stimulus. So if there's any hyperpolarization left at the end of this action potential, that counteracts what this generator potential can do in terms of reaching threshold. All right. But if we come along with even a greater stimulus now, after the first action potential, there is still plenty of depolarization left to reach threshold, and an action potential will follow much more closely in time. And even though there is a relative refractory period after this second action potential, there's still plenty of generator potential to overcome that hyperpolarization. And another action potential follows very quickly after the first. All right, so you can see that the frequency of action potentials is related to the intensity of the stimulus because the intensity of the graded potential scales by the intensity of the stimulus right here. So this is what we call frequency coding from a previous chapter. All right, so let's look at some special senses. Let's see what I can remember about these things. All right, taste and smell. Receptors are what we call exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals in the environment, so it allows you to communicate with the environment, at least in one direction. Interoceptors respond to chemicals in your internal environment, like the pancreas has glucose receptors, and your brain has pH receptors or hydrogen ion receptors. Those would be interoceptors. Okay, let's look at taste. And the name for taste is the gustatory sense or gustation. And this is a special sense because the only place where you can taste something is on your tongue, because you have something called a taste bud. So here is a taste bud, and I can see it has a number of cells to it. In this case, I don't know, maybe there's 10 or 15 cells right here. There are some epithelial cells and then some taste cells, and it forms like a little pocket. Here is a hole in the surface of the tongue that taste molecules enter via with saliva. Okay, so this right here is a taste bud. Now, can you see these on your tongue? No, because here are cells. What do you need to see a cell? You need a microscope, right? So this is a microscopic structure. Taste bud is a microscopic structure, but what you do see on your tongue is a papillae, and you have thousands of taste buds on every papillae, just to give you a sense of scale. Okay. All right, so every particular... So here we have a taste cell, and there are a bunch of little, like almost like cilia sticking off the apical surface right here. We just call that a taste hair. And there are receptors for different kinds of compounds. And when a compound binds to receptors in this region right here, that changes the electrical property of the taste cell, which then releases something like a neurotransmitter, which can excite this sensory nerve fiber, and away action potentials go to the brain. And there's still a lot of discussion about the primary sensations for taste, but this is probably pretty good. There are five primary sensations: sweet, sour, bitter, and umami, which gives you the sense of fulfillment when you eat something, usually due to amino acids that are in the diet. Okay, so these various substances can affect depolarization of a taste cell right here, which then will send action potentials to the brain. And oh, you know what? These categories are pretty well worked out. What is not worked out, sorry, is exactly where these taste buds are located in your mouth. There's a lot of different thought about that. Like, you might have sweet taste on the tip of your tongue and on the margins of your tongue, and sour in the back, okay? But it seems that there's more variability in people than first imagined, and some cultural heritage might play a big role and just our appreciation for taste. So that still has to be worked out. But how do different chemicals affect the electrical properties of cells? That's where these slides come in. All right, so don't forget that a tastant molecule has to dissolve in saliva, and it has to enter a taste bud, and it has to bind to or somehow interact with the cell through some kind of receptor. So salty is one of the primary sensations. Oh, let me go back and look at this right here. All right, so we can analyze a particular food taste by monitoring how sweet it is, how sour it is, how bitter it is, and how salty it is all at the same time. And then we can identify what kind of food it is, right, or what kind of drink it is. So, for instance, if I were to hand you a margarita, just a typical margarita, what would it taste like? It would be salty because you didn't ask for no salt. Okay, but you can't tell if it's a margarita just by tasting the salt. What else would you experience? The sour, okay, and you'd also taste some sweetness, right? And just with the right combinations of those different primary sensations, you could tell what kind of food it was. Okay, so breaking a food down into these basic components right here is a way that you can identify a particular food. All right, so for this one dimension of salt, here we have a taste cell. And here is a sodium channel in the taste hair. So when there is a lot of salt in your saliva, of course, sodium breaks away from chloride and dissociates. So now you have a high concentration of sodium in saliva that has entered a taste bud. And here is a sodium channel that is normally open. And so sodium then enters the cell. And what do you know about sodium entering a cell? It's excitatory. It causes depolarization of this receptor cell right here. Just by putting sodium in your mouth, depolarizes the cell. And when it depolarizes, then calcium channels down here by the basal region of the cell open up, and calcium rushes into the cell, and that's basically what we know about synaptic. Have we talked about synaptic transmission in here yet? Maybe. We did neuro. Yeah, we did neuro already. Sure. Synaptic transmission. So calcium enters, and you know that causes diffusion and docking of these vesicles, release of neurotransmitter, which is excitatory on this neuron, and away action potentials go to the brain as sodium concentration increases. So there are certain taste cells that have sodium channels, and that gives you the perception of saltiness in your food. Okay. Now, sour is a different kind of ion. Sour is due to an increase in acidity, which is a decrease in pH of something that we're eating. All right? And in some taste cells, here is a channel particular for hydrogen ion, a lot smaller than sodium, so it's a lot smaller channel. And when hydrogen ion enters the cell, what happens to this cell? Because what kind of ion is a hydrogen ion? Yeah, it's a cation, right? So it has a positive charge. And when a positive charge enters the cell, what's going to happen to it? It's going to depolarize, and depolarization is what we consider an excitatory event, which then causes these voltage-gated channels for calcium to open up. Calcium floods the cell, just like over here, and then that releases neurotransmitter on this afferent neuron. All right, so sour is pretty easy to understand, just by these hydrogen ions depolarizing the cell because the cell has placed specific proton channels in the membrane. So that's salty and sour, just simple ion channels. All right, but we have some other things. Sweet and bitter have receptors, but they act through G-protein-coupled receptors. All right, so a G-protein-coupled receptor means that there's a receptor on the outside of the cell, which then causes the dissociation of a G-protein. Remember, there's the alpha, beta, and gamma subunits. That breaks away from the receptor, and those subunits can bump into other kinds of maybe enzymes or ion channels in the cell membrane, causing a change in physiology of the cell. All right, so let's look at sweet and umami. Binds to a membrane receptor. Now, in this particular case, right, we have a first messenger and a second messenger. The first messenger, let's just say the sugar molecule, because it kind of looks like a little stop sign right here. It's got to have the right shape. Binds to a receptor, which then activates a G protein, which then causes the development of a second messenger inside the cell. Like, for instance, what could be a second messenger inside the cell? Like maybe cyclic AMP. Maybe when that G protein dissociates, it bumps into adenylate cyclase, activates adenylate cyclase, which then converts ATP into cyclic AMP. And so now we have the second messenger inside the cell. And where is the first messenger always? It's trapped outside the cell, right? Because that's a nice hydrophilic molecule, polar molecule, can't get inside the cell. So here is that step of signal transduction. Second messenger develops inside the cell, and it's going to run around inside the cell, and it's going to bump into potassium channels, which are normally open. Which means what? If these potassium channels are normally open under normal conditions, what's the state of this cell? It's hyperpolarized, right, because potassium is leaving, which is what? Inhibited. This cell is inhibited. But once sugar binds to this receptor right here, then these potassium channels close, right, and that causes depolarization. as a result, the opposite physiologic effect. So that's the stimulatory effect that causes release of neurotransmitter in a way action potentials go to the brain. Okay, so that's for sweet and umami. Bitter is sort of the same kind of thing, just a little bit different. A good example of a bitter substance would be quinine that you might find in tonic water, which has a bitter taste. It's different than salty, different than sour, right? And again, that quinine molecule doesn't enter the cell. It's the first messenger that develops a second messenger inside the cell through a G-protein coupled receptor. And usually these are cascade mechanisms with different levels of amplification. That's why they're so nifty. And in this particular case, this second messenger opens up calcium channels. And in this particular case, the calcium channels are on the extracellular membrane, so calcium enters the cell, and that causes the docking and fusion of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, which then causes excitation on the afferent neuron. In a way, action potentials go to the brain. So these are pretty important exam figures for you to know. Some are just simple ion channels, and some are G-protein coupled receptors for the different sensations. Okay, so check your study guides to see how that works. Well, the sense of olfaction works pretty much the same way, except there's more than just five different kinds of receptors. Right? They're located in olfactory epithelia in the top of the nose right here. So when I'm looking at this, oh, this looks like a nice frontal bone because there's a frontal paranasal sinus right there. There's a sphenoid paranasal sinus, and then up in this region is going to be the ethmoid bone, just sort of making sense to you, and the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone has all of these holes in it that we call olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate, and through these different foramina are the olfactory nerves that pass through, and this is the only place in the body where you actually have part of your nervous system just dangling in open space. Right, so these nerves are just hanging inside your nasal cavity. Yeah, they might have some mucus around them, something like that, but they're just exposed to whatever we're breathing in and breathing out. And as a result, guess what happens to these neurons right here? They have a really tough life because they're just exposed to whatever we breathe in, so they don't live for very long. Okay, so there are stem cells that replace these neurons that die. So let's zoom into this region and take a little bit better look of what's happening. So here is the epithelium, and we have some olfactory receptor neurons here, okay, and here, and they have cilia on them. That should remind you of a taste bud, right? Because a taste bud has receptor cells that have hair on them, and they're just modified cilia, okay? And then here is just the columnar cells that make up the epithelium, and also in this region, there are going to be stem cells that can replace these neurons. Okay, for instance, here's probably a stem cell, here's probably a stem cell, so that when these neurons actually die, these can sort of take over the job. And these cells right here have a special shape. Can anybody recognize these neurons by their shape right here? This is a bipolar neuron. And the only place where we find bipolar neurons are in this organs for special sensation. Okay, nowhere else in the nervous system. So here is the dendrite, here is the axon. Okay, so then these receptor cells send action potentials up into the olfactory bulb, which have accumulations of glomeruli, and there's some signal processing taking on that takes place in this region, all right, and then the olfactory bulb sends olfactory information to the olfactory center in the central nervous system. All right, but an odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor on the cilia. So if there is an odorant molecule in the back of the room, there's no way that I could perceive that molecule. It actually has to end up in your nose and bind to the cilia right here. Okay, so olfactory apparatus has receptor cells, support cells, and basal cells. The receptor cells are bipolar neurons. And they send axons into the olfactory bulb. You probably remember where those are. The basal cells are stem cells that reproduce new receptor cells every 1 to 2 months. Okay, but I suppose somebody could damage this epithelium to such a great degree, maybe by breathing in very hot gases or noxious chemicals like an acid or other kinds of things that can damage this epithelium and even kill the stem cells, and in that case, then that person's sense of smell will never grow back as a result of that, right, if those stem cells are damaged. right? And the supporting cells contain detoxifying enzymes just to help these cells live a little bit longer. Okay, and the sense of smell produced by odorant molecules bind to receptors that act through G proteins. There are no direct ion channels, and we probably have thousands of different kinds of primary sensations for smell. Right? This is one of the oldest sensations, and so it's not simply five like we had for the gustatory sense, but there are thousands of different kinds of receptors, and we don't spend a lot of time talking about that. But if somebody's interested, I think I have some information on what kind of primary sensations you can smell, and then you figure out what something is by the percentage of how each of these different particular sensations are added together in your brain. Okay, let's move on to ears and hearing. And, of course, you know that this is in the temporal bone. It's between the external acoustic meatus and the internal acoustic meatus, which is what we call the petrous region in the temporal bone. It has a bony labyrinth, and inside that bony labyrinth, there is a membranous labyrinth that contains receptor organs and receptor cells for three different kinds of energy. All right, so the vestibular apparatus, we see the vestibule right here. And then we see the semicircular canals, three semicircular canals. And then we see something that looks like a snail right here. That's the cochlea. All right, and we have three different senses. The cochlea is what's responsible for the sense of hearing. And in the vestibule, that gives you a sense of static equilibrium or linear acceleration. Just linear acceleration, that means going in a straight line, either straight forward and back, straight right to left, or straight up and down, right? And the semicircular canals right here are responsible for angular acceleration, like when you start to spin or stop spinning. And you can see that, how many different dimensions can you spin in? Okay, because there's three dimensions in space, there's three different ways that you can spin, so we have three semicircular canals to actually monitor how we're spinning in those three different dimensions, and depending on the proportion of these three dimensions right here that are stimulated, your brain can figure out exactly what direction you're spinning in. Okay. So we see a nice horizontal plane, a coronal plane, and a sagittal plane right here. In the vestibule, we only have two organs, right? And they're the utricle and saccule, and therefore monitoring linear acceleration. So for instance, if you're in a car and you're traveling 60 miles an hour and you stay traveling at 60 miles an hour, then the vestibular apparatus can't tell you any information because you're not changing your velocity. But if you start to change your velocity, then you either accelerate if your velocity increases or you decelerate if your velocity starts to go down. So that's what the vestibular apparatus actually maintains or can monitor, because there's fluid inside these chambers, but there's also crystals of calcium carbonate. We call these otoliths. And those crystals of calcium carbonate act like little weights inside the vestibule that then are acted on by forces when you accelerate. All right, so utricle, linear acceleration, semicircular canals, angular acceleration. So how does that happen? All right, so let's look at a nice microscopic exam of some sensory cells inside the vestibule. And these cells we call hair cells, because sticking off the top, we have these cilia. And we call these stereocilia. There's one big one here called the kinocilium, and they're connected to the rest of the cilia on top of this hair cell. And when these cilia bend, it changes the electrical property of this cell. We're going to see it probably changes how ion channels open in. So this is a nice mechanoreceptor. All right, so when these stereocilia get bent, okay, to the right, that inhibits the cell. It produces very few action potentials. But if they bend to the left, then it produces many more action potentials per time. So this is just how, again, an example of frequency coding. So let's see if we have an example. Yes, the utricle and saccule for linear acceleration. All right, so here we have a diagram of a utricle or a saccule This organ right here is called a macula. And you have two of those. One is called the utricle, the other is the saccule. Here you have hair cells. I can see some hairs sticking up right here. They're sticking up into an otolithic membrane. It's just a gelatinous mass. And then on top of this gelatinous mass are these otoliths, which are just crystals of calcium carbonate. And so they respond to gravity. And so when you're standing upright with your head upright like that, gravity is pushing straight down on the stereocilia, and they don't bend as a result because they're tubular structures. They stay upright. But as soon as you tilt your head forward, guess what happens? Gravity pulls on these otoliths, pulls on this gelatinous membrane, and it bends the stereocilia, and this changes how action potentials reach the brain or the frequency of action potentials reaching the brain. All right, so depending on which way these hairs bend, whether your head is pointing forward, there's a decrease in action potentials. If you were to bend your head backward, there would be an increase in action potentials. And by looking at those different frequencies of action potentials, you have a sense of head position just due to gravity. Okay, so the utricle is sensitive to horizontal acceleration, right? So going forwards and backwards. And the saccule is sensitive to vertical acceleration. So that's, we're going up and down. All right, those are the only two senses. You don't have any sensation for changing velocity when you move from right to left. It's only up and down, forwards and backwards. Because you only have two maculae, that's the utricle and saccule. All right, let's look at the semicircular canals. The semicircular canals, we have three of them right here. You have an anterior, posterior, and lateral semicircular canal, and there's fluid in all of these canals that we call endolymph. The organ for this particular sense, and this sense is, dynamic equilibrium or angular acceleration. And the reason why you can see this is angular acceleration, because if there is fluid in this circular canal, it means that fluid can actually flow in a circle within this canal, right? It doesn't get trapped anywhere. It can actually flow in a circle, right? And there is an organ in this bulge at the base of a semicircular canal. This bulge is what we call the ampule, and the organ inside is called the crista ampullaris, right? And remember, the name for static equilibrium was a maculae inside the utricle and saccule. Well, the organ in here is the crista ampullaris. And that's why it needs a little bulge. And as a matter of fact, the crista ampullaris has hair cells that make up this organ. And there is another gelatinous mass right here that we call the cupula that goes across the semicircular canal, and fluid can actually kind of flow past these things a little bit. So when they flow past the cupula, it will bend this material, which will then bend the stereocilia on these hair cells, which then changes the electrical properties of a hair cell. So the receptor cell is exactly the same in the crista ampullaris and the maculae. And what's the name of these cells for linear acceleration and angular acceleration? Kind of funny. They are called hair cells, because they have these stereocilia on them. And when the stereocilia bend, it changes the electrical properties. Okay, so how does that happen? Oh, I should have brought an example. Maybe I can find... I need somebody's bottle of water. I like this one. Almost. I don't know. I need... A full bottle would be better. Okay. So here we have the endolymph inside the semicircular canal. And if you're just standing still for a long period of time, what can you tell me about that endolymph? It's just standing still, right? Because it has inertia. The mass has inertia, and a property of inertia just says that if there's mass in motion, then it wants to stay in motion. That's what its natural tendency is. But if mass is stationary, it's going to have a tendency just to stay put, right? So that's what inertia means. All right, so Thanksgiving is coming up. Thank goodness, a little vacation. So you're going to go home and maybe set a table. We have some friends come over, and you put some candlesticks on the table and some wine glasses and champagne bottle and wine bottles and everything. plates and silverware, and you're going to demonstrate this property of inertia to your friends, because you're going to grab the tablecloth and pull the tablecloth off, and nothing's going to spill on the floor. Okay? So this piece of paper right here is going to represent the crista ampullaris that can move, okay? And this bottle is going to represent the endolymph. So as you walk up to the table and pull the tablecloth, what's going to happen to this endolymph? It's just going to stay right there, right? Just like that. No problem. So the crista ampullaris moved a lot, but the fluid inside the semicircular canal didn't move. So that means when the crista ampullaris moves, this fluid puts pressure on the hair cells, and it bends the hair cells one way. Okay? All right. But now, if all of a sudden I start spinning, that would probably freak all of you out. Okay? So I'll start spinning. Okay? And then stop. What happens? I know most of you did this last night. And stop. What happens? Open your eyes. You still see the world spinning around, even though you are not moving. Right? So in that particular case, when you spin a lot, that means the crista ampullaris is moving. And then after a period of time, the endolymph kind of speeds up and starts traveling at the same speed as the crista ampullaris. And then if you stop all of a sudden, what happens? If you stop all of a sudden, it's supposed to go like that. I didn't go fast enough. Okay. So the fluid inside the endolymph keeps spinning after the crista ampullaris stops. Like that. That's better. Okay? And since the fluid is moving inside the circular canal, it bends the stereocilia the other way, which changes the amount of action potentials going to the brain. Okay? Hopefully I didn't make things more confusing rather than less confusing. So because of this endolymph has inertia, okay, it's going to bend these stereocilia, not when you're spinning at a constant velocity, but when you start to spin. Right? Or when you stop spinning suddenly, then the stereocilia get bent one way or the other, which changes the number of action potentials going to the brain. Okay, so those are the two senses so far of the three inside the ear. All right, the next one is hearing. So let's just develop a little bit of terminology. Sound waves are physical pressure waves moving through air, so they don't move through a vacuum like outer space. Molecules have to pound into each other for this wave to travel. And sound energy travels in all directions from its source, and kind of like a graded potential, as it moves farther away from the source, then the intensity of that sound wave decreases. Right? The frequency is measured in cycles per second, and another name for cycles per second is what we call a hertz. Pitch is directly related to the frequency. So the lower the frequency is, the fewer cycles per second, the lower in tone it sounds. The more cycles per second, the higher the frequency is. Right? And the intensity is the loudness of that energy wave that's moving through space, which is what? The amplitude, the peak of a sound wave. So if we were to look at a wave, right, we would say we could have a wave like this, and then we could have a wave like this. All right, the amplitude is from this average to a peak value, and the frequency would be from maybe from peak to the peak of the next wave, or the beginning of a wave to the beginning of the next wave. So this is a low frequency, while this one, you measure from here to here, this is a high frequency because you get more waves for a certain period of time. So this would be a high frequency sound, this would be a low frequency sound, and if I drew it exactly right, okay, then that would be the exact same intensity or same loudness. So loudness and intensity would be the same. And we could do this in lab. We could measure your hearing, and what we would measure, the sound pressure, or your would be measured in what we call something called decibels. All right, so here is a pretty nice figure that you should remember from anatomy. It has the three parts of the ear. And first off, we have the external ear or outer ear. And then here's the external acoustic meatus. And then we have the tympanic membrane. And sound pressure can vibrate this tympanic membrane as long as there's no pressure in the middle ear. So here we have the middle ear. Right? And the middle ear should have the same pressure as the external ear so that this membrane can vibrate back and forth. And that pressure is equalized because here's the pharyngeal tympanic tube or eustachian tube that connects the middle part of the ear with the pharynx. Right? And so if this tube gets plugged up, like when you have a cold, right, or allergies or something, then you might not be able to hear very well because the tympanic membrane can't vibrate because there's too much junk in this compartment. Right? You might have fluid in there, or maybe it's too high a pressure and the membrane can't vibrate, so sound will be attenuated. All right, so the tympanic membrane vibrates, then that vibration is transmitted through the auditory ossicles. You probably remember the name of the auditory ossicles, the incus, malleus, and stapes. Right? And that acts as a little lever system, which takes the vibrations from the tympanic membrane and introduces them into the vestibule right here. There's a membrane underneath the stapes that we call the oval window, and that's easy to remember because if you look at the shape of the stapes right here, you can see that it's a nice oval, and it fits right on the oval window. So that produces that the stapes vibrates back and forth and then generates the pressure waves inside the endolymph, inside the vestibule right here, which then travel around through the cochlea. All right, so what this apparatus is, we see that the tympanic membrane surface area is large. The surface area of the oval window is pretty small. So small changes, small amplitude waves on the tympanic membrane will produce large amplitude changes on the oval window. So this is a way that evolution has figured out how to take sound energy and put it in a water environment, which is necessary for hearing. All right, so if I was lecturing right now and you were sitting at the edge of a pool, and you're sitting on the deck of a pool right now and I'm talking, you could hear me just fine. But what happens if you dropped your pen and it went in the pool, so you had to dive into the pool to get your pen, and as soon as your ears are underwater and I'm still talking the same intensity, what would happen to my voice? You could hardly hear me, right? Because sound energy really doesn't like to penetrate water. It doesn't have the right kind of properties. So this device right here, the ratio of surface area and this lever system right here makes or allows sound energy to enter the water environment of this ear so that you have decent hearing. So it acts like amplification. I guess that's all I'm going to say about that. It acts like something else. Okay. But that amplifies the sound so that it can get into the inner ear. So you got the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. So here's the vestibule that we looked for static, we learned about static equilibrium. Here are the semicircular canals for angular acceleration. These are all in the inner ear. So one thing that you should appreciate is, for the sense of angular acceleration and linear acceleration, do you need an outer ear? And do you need a middle ear? The answer would be no. You just need these apparatuses inside the inner ear for equilibrium senses. Now, what about hearing? What happens if we were to take away the middle ear or outer ear, and we're just left with the inner ear, the cochlea right here? Then you wouldn't be able to hear anything. So for the sense of hearing, you need the outer, middle, and inner ear, but for the senses of equilibrium, you just need the inner ear. Okay, so the bony labyrinth for hearing is the cochlea, the snail-shaped object right here. And it looks like a snail because it's all curled up on each other. Okay, and what the cochlea really is it's a piano, basically. Okay, so what a piano, what's a piano? It has two sides, the right side and the left side. And if you hit some keys on the left side, what's your perception? What do you hear? Low frequencies. And then if you hit some keys on the right side, you hear some high frequencies, right? And then if you hit something in the middle, then you hear some mid-range type frequencies. And the reason why that is, for one form or another, the low frequencies are produced by strings that are really long and thick. Okay, they have a natural tendency to vibrate at a lower frequency. The keys on the right bang into strings that are really short and thin. They just have a natural tendency to vibrate at a higher frequency. So depending on what the thickness and length of those strings are, different frequencies will just be produced to the natural resonance frequency. So when sound enters the cochlea, let's look at this next slide here. All right, so here's the tympanic membrane. Here's in the middle ear, you have the malleus, incus, and stapes. Here's the oval window. That's going to produce sound waves inside the cochlea. And I can see this cochlea has been unwound into just a flat structure. Okay, but in real life, why does it look like a snail? because this thing right here is really a piano. High frequency, it's a little bit different. High frequencies are on this end, the low frequencies are over here, the mid-range frequencies are in the middle, right? So it's really a piano, but the reason why it's all rolled up is because if we had these keyboards in our petrous region of the temporal bone, they would be sticking outside our heads, right? So evolution has figured a way to roll up that keyboard, stick it inside the cochlea so that it can perceive different frequencies by location within the cochlea, and yet it's still nicely hidden inside your head. Okay, so let's take a look at this. What can I remember about this? This upper chamber right here is called the scala vestibuli. The bottom chamber is called the scala tympani. Is that on this slide anywhere? Yeah, it is. Okay, good. And the fluid is called the perilymph. All right, so the sound energy enters the ear and it starts to rattle around inside the cochlea. But there's an inner tube right here that has another kind of fluid in it that we call the endolymph. This is probably just a review for you from anatomy. And this is called the cochlear duct. So sound energy can enter via the scala vestibuli and end up in the scala tympani right here as long as it can find a pathway through some part of, and this right here inside the cochlea is called the organ of Corti. As long as it can find a natural place of resonance, right, like if it's a low frequency, it's got to travel all the way into the end of the cochlea, which we call the helicotrema, before it can go across the organ of Corti. And when that sound energy moves across the organ of Corti, it starts to vibrate just this part of it. It doesn't vibrate over here, and it doesn't vibrate over here. So there are cells that pick up that vibration that send action potentials to the brain, and the brain knows it's coming from this part of the cochlea, which is way off to the right. Higher frequencies will excite just this part over here, right, closest to the oval window. And that sends action potentials to that part of the brain, which you think then is a high frequency. All right, so this organ is acting just like a piano inside your ear. So if we make a cut through the cochlea, here is the bony labyrinth right here of the cochlea. Here's the membranous labyrinth inside the cochlea. Here's the scala vestibuli that's attached to the oval window. So sound enters this one, enters this chamber right here, and then it can move across, right, the cochlear duct, and enter the scala tympani. Oh, let me go back to a previous slide. Enters the scala tympani, and that pressure wave then bounces into a round window, just a membranous window right here. And that's important because the oval window is pressurizing the cochlea, and that's a lot of energy. That could break things in the middle ear, inside the inner ear. So that energy has to have a way to escape, and it escapes because the round window can vibrate back and forth. So if this was just a solid wall right here, the sound energy could damage the cochlear duct. And as a matter of fact, if the sound energy is high enough in intensity, even with a round window, you can still damage the cochlea as a result of that with too high intensity of sound. Okay, so if the sound wave matches up to the length of, or the shape of this tectorial membrane, then it's going to vibrate, right? If the wavelength of sound doesn't match up to the tectorial membrane, it's not going to vibrate. So if this tectorial membrane is down by the helicotrema, it's very large and it vibrates at a low frequency, just like the large strings inside a piano vibrate at a low frequency. And the tectorial membrane is going to vibrate up and down. And attached to the tectorial membrane are some of these hair cells right here. So I'm going to zoom into this region to talk about it, but we have sound energy passing through the cochlear duct, right? If the shape of this tectorial membrane matches the shape of that sound energy frequency, okay? Here are the hair cells. These are the receptor cells. Here's a tectorial membrane that vibrates back and forth. And then that will change the amount of neurotransmitter released on these sensory nerve fibers, right? And here's the vestibulocochlear nerve that takes these auditory signals eventually to the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. All right, so the sound waves actually have to vibrate this tectorial membrane. Okay, here's a pathway. One last thing I want to say. When we look at the cochlea, we don't get a really good sense of what's happening here, because it looks like this region here is thicker than this region, out here near the helicotrema, okay, which is kind of a misrepresentation. The thickness from right to left, which we can't really see on this diagram, is really thin in this part of the cochlea. So this is the thinnest part of the cochlea. And as you get further and further out to the helicotrema, okay, the cochlea gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker. So that means these thicker regions will have a tendency to vibrate at a lower frequency. So that's why this region right here, right, vibrates at a low frequency, because if you look from one side to the other, this would be the thickest part of the cochlea. Okay, and here's the thinnest part of the cochlea. So just the shape of the cochlea and organ of Corti will determine where that tectorial membrane is going to vibrate. All right, so sounds then, or action potentials, reach the vestibular cochlear nerve from the organ of Corti. So this thing right here is the organ of Corti. All right, and in the medulla, the sound is then processed a little bit and sent into the inferior colliculus. That's part of the midbrain. Maybe you can remember where the inferior colliculus is. And in anatomy, you had to memorize that that was an important part of the brain, because this is the part of the brain that allows you to localize where sound is coming from. We see it coming only from the right side of this person, but information is coming from the left side as well. And the inferior colliculus can compare that same signal from different parts of the body, different sides of the body. So if it reaches the right side before the left, then it knows that the sound is originating from the right side of your body. And if it reaches the left ear first, then you know that it's originating from the left side of your body. But if both ears hear the sound at the same time, what does the superior or the inferior colliculus know? That it's right in front of you. Okay, so we call that localization. So we could do an experiment, but don't have time. We could close your eyes right now. I could open that door. I could open that door, or that one in the back, or that one in the back. And even with your eyes closed, you would be able to tell where the sound is coming from, because of the way it's processed right here in the inferior colliculus. Then there's another neuron that takes it to the thalamus. The thalamus, remember, is a relay station. It doesn't send it to the primary somatosensory cortex, doesn't send it to the occipital lobe, but it sends it to the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe right here. And in the temporal lobe, there are neurons that are all lined up. And if we stimulate, do I have a picture? No, I don't have a picture. But if we stimulate some on this end, you'll hear low frequency. If we stimulate some in the middle, we'll hear some kind of mid-range frequency. And if we stimulate some way out here on the end, we'll hear a high frequency. So what do you really have in the temporal lobe? You have another piano right in there that can then break complex sounds down into their basic components of frequency. And if you put three frequencies together with a proper distance between them, or proper interval, then that produces a chord. Okay, so that's how we interpret sound, right? By having these pianos in our temporal lobe and pianos in our inner ear. All right, so let's just revisit some of these different structures for the ear. And maybe this is a good place. Okay, so for the sense of hearing, what parts of the ear do we need? Outer, middle, or inner? You need all three. What about for the two senses of equilibrium? Only the inner ear, okay? All right, well, let's go back to hearing. And what is the bony labyrinth for hearing? The bony labyrinth is the cochlea. And there's an organ inside the cochlea that allows you to hear. That has to be nice and healthy. It's got to vibrate. All right, what's the name of that organ for hearing? And as a matter of fact, oh, did I pass the sign? Oh, I didn't bring a sign-in sheet today. You got one going? Thank you. Okay, so what's the organ for? Too bad I had one. Okay, what's the organ inside the cochlea that allows you to hear? It's called the organ of Corti. And what's the receptor cell inside the organ of Corti? A hair cell. Are you kidding me? You're not kidding me. Here's a hair cell right here. Here are hair cells. Indeed, they're hair cells that allow you to hear, because sound is just a mechanical wave that's traveling through space that can bend these stereo cilia on top of this hair cell, which then changes the electrical properties of a hair cell. All right, so for hearing, you have the bony labyrinth is the cochlea, right? The organ is the organ of Corti, and the receptor cell is a hair cell. All right, what about the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium? Or another way to talk about static equilibrium is linear acceleration. That is the The bony labyrinth is the vestibule, and the organ is a maculae. And what does a maculae contain? What's the receptor cell for a maculae that allows you the sense of linear acceleration or deceleration? That's a hair cell once again, right? Because that hair cell has the stereocilia poking up into the gelatinous mass that have otoliths on it, and when those otoliths bend those stereocilia, then it changes the frequency of action potentials to the brain. All right, and then what's the third sense? So we have hearing, we have a static equilibrium or linear acceleration, and then the third one is angular acceleration, or sometimes we call it kinetic equilibrium or dynamic equilibrium. Right? It's still acceleration. It still means you have to be changing something, but what has to change in order to stimulate the semicircular canals? The rate at which you're spinning or twirling. If you're twirling at a constant speed, then it's not going to excite the semicircular canals, but when you start, it does, and then if you stop suddenly, it does. All right? So, and then the organ for angular acceleration is called the crista ampullaris, right inside the ampule of the semicircular canals. And what's the organ? No, not the organ. The organ is the crista ampullaris, but the receptor cell. It's a hair cell. So a hair cell is used in the crista ampullaris. It's used in the maculae. It's used in the organ of Corti, right, to produce these vastly different kinds of sensations. It all depends on how it's hooked up to the other structures inside that bony labyrinth. And of course, your brain can tell these different sensations from each other, right? Because they're all the same inside the cochlear nerve. How is that information transmitted within the cochlear nerve? Whether it's spinning or whether it's linear acceleration, a change in spinning or a change in linear acceleration or a change in sound pressure. It's always going to be action potentials, but the reason why it's different because those action potentials go to different parts of your cerebral cortex. Just the way our brain is wired. Okay. So we did not get done today. So we're going to talk about vision next time. Okay, and then move on to some other material. Really good figures, and here's an exam figure for vision. There's probably some other, maybe this is an exam figure, I'm not sure. All right, but vision also requires G-protein coupled receptors, which is pretty interesting. All right, so we'll talk about this next time. Yeah, so try and find that sign-in sheet. Do we have an exam next week? No, oh good, I don't have to write an exam over the weekend. That is so nice. But you guys got to study harder than you usually do before an exam. As hard or harder, right?